Right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the London School of Economics. On behalf of the London School of Economics and the Royal Academy, sitting next to me is Mary-Ann Stevens, who's the Collection Secretary of the RA, and she will in a moment also just tell you a little bit about what the Royal Academy does for architecture, which is a lot. And one of the key things it does, it helps us at the LSE organize and sponsor a series of lectures which bring together the worlds of art, the worlds of social science, and the worlds of architecture and urban design. And I think, Mary-Ann, it's the third series that we've actually worked together. And this is the inaugural lecture by Kees Christiaanse, who we welcome here. The third of the series and the first of the talks this year, which are about the relationship between dwelling and design. And obviously, just in having that title of dwelling and design, the whole issue of how people live in cities, the social aspects, the economic aspects, the cultural aspects of living in cities, and the design aspects of what we will be focusing on in this and following lectures later this term. But before I introduce Kees slightly more formally with a bit of sort of personal history, probably informally I mean, perhaps Mary-Ann, you wanted to say a few words about the Royal Academy.
Thank you very much, and again, welcome to this evening. It's marvelous that we have here now the beginning of our third series of collaboration between two institutions, both of whom are very committed to architecture and to design. And I thought, since many of you may not be entirely familiar with the fact that the Royal Academy has now a growing architectural dimension to its activities, it would be useful just to explain a little bit of its background and the range of what it does. One has to remember that the Royal Academy is very old, relatively venerable. It's been an institution that has, in a sense, reinvented itself probably about every 30, 40 years. It does, of course, go back to 1768, which is a little bit longer ago than LSE. 100. That gives us a bit of an edge. And it was founded by painters, sculptors, and architects. And from the very beginning, it had a remit for architecture alongside the other manifestations of visual arts. And when I first came to the Royal Academy a little while ago, I was very struck by the fact that whereas the other dimensions of the Royal Academy's remit were being extremely well served, architecture seemed to be somewhat limping, and yet we had this incredibly strong membership of architects, leading architects, who are elected to a very small number of places which are kept steady from year to year, i.e. 14 members. And so it was really in the light of that that we felt we should be moving ahead to raise the banner again for architecture at the Royal Academy. Over the last 15 years or so, we have been developing a program which covers the range of education programs, i.e. lectures, debates, forums on the one hand, and on the other, exhibitions. In terms of the debates and forums and lectures, those both relate to individual topics which we feel are of particular reference to the temporary loan exhibition program, but certainly these are not what I would call historical lectures. We very much focus on the contemporary, and at the same time, as far as the forums and debates are concerned, focus very much on placing architecture within a broader remit, not just of the other visual arts represented within the academy, but also raising issues which are pertinent to architects and other people working within the cultural field of today. If you want to know more about it, we have brought, of course, a set of leaflets here, which will be available for you at the end of the lecture, so do please feel free to pick one of those up. And we look forward to seeing you within our midst. Thank you very much.
Mary-Ann, thank you. One of the central themes of the LSE Cities program, which I run with Catherine Firth, has been and still is the connection between the creation of place for people to live in and the changing face of cities. And one city which is facing this enormous pace of change is the one we're sitting in now, the one we're living in, studying in, working in. And the context very much of these series of discussions is to help us as professionals, as policymakers, as architects, understand what it is we ought to be doing. And that is said in not in a context of fake modesty, but full realization that we haven't necessarily got it right. What do I mean by that? As London, like other cities in the UK, are growing, and London is set to grow in the next 15 years by 700,000 people, that's the city of Frankfurt, plonked onto London, it's going to grow by 400,000 more jobs, and that means 400,000 more dwellings. That's an enormous amount of mass which is going to be built in this city over the next 15 years. We recognize, and that was the point I was making before, that we haven't got it right, because if you look at what's happening, say, as you go east along the River Thames, beyond Canary Wharf, beyond the Isle of Dogs, is a series of, some cases pretty, some cases extremely ugly, some cases large, some cases small, pieces of self-contained enclaves of development, whether it's housing, whether it's shopping, whether it's even Canary Wharf as a massive, and in certain respects, massively successful place where people work and do business. And what is interesting us as we look forward, and by us I mean those involved, as I am at the moment with Mark Brearley and others at the Greater London Authority with Ken Livingstone, but also those who are studying the city, what we're interested in is to see how some of the models across continental Europe might or might not apply to what we're doing here. That model, I think, is something which Case will describe simply through the work he's done, which is more integrated, more mixed as a type of development, less ghettoized than the one I've described. And we want to try and understand how you get to the bottom of that. The reason we've invited Case to start this lecture series and start this discussion is, I think, self-evident from the work. His title of his talk is Housing and Harbours. He's actually going to show a series of projects which relate to water. Now, if you think that the Thames Gateway relates to water with this wonderful, massive, brown, horrible, but also beautiful at some points river, the River Thames, as it winds its way east and becomes larger and more wild as you go beyond the Thames barrier, these are the lessons that I think we need to learn by looking at the projects that you have been doing, Case. Case is a strange and interesting animal. He's a very successful academic, and he's also a very successful practitioner. He is professor of architecture and urbanism and urban design, and the fact that you are a professor of both, I think, is extremely significant. He's the head of the Institute of Urban Design at the ETH in Zurich, probably one of the best schools of architecture and urban design in the world, I would suggest. But he also happens to run a practice which has nearly 100 architects and urban designers and planners called KCAP, Case Christiaanse Architects and Planners, which has its major office in Rotterdam, but also 30-odd people in Cologne and a new and emerging office in Zurich. The appointment in Zurich, in fact, quite recent after many years of teaching at the Technical University of Berlin. What interested me in the conversations I've been having with Case, and not only seeing his work, but also seeing and reading texts about his work, is the notions that he's developed, which are very central to the way cities are expanding. The notion of flexibility in design, he in fact, I think, is one of the first people who used the notion as a city as loft, that you design cities as spaces which can adapt to whatever the market or whatever the policymakers actually bring to it, and not create fixed environments which can't change and respond to what's happening. He also distinguishes himself amongst the architectural community here for being one of the founding members of the extremely well-known, I was about to say notorious, and I didn't mean that, firm Office for Metropolitan Architecture, OMA, which he in fact founded with Rem Koolhaas. As he said, it was a floating gang of people in London at that time, and then the office was formalized and set up in Germany. In Rotterdam, not in Germany. Now, what is interesting is that Rem Koolhaas has recently written extensively about the problems of architecture and urban design and tackling the problems of contemporary society. And in a famous essay, Whatever Happened to Urbanism, he basically argues that urbanism is not really possible in the context of what we are all doing. And I think the reason I'm interested in Case's work is that many of the answers to actually what is urbanism today lie in the work that he and his practice and his colleagues are doing. So I look forward to some lecture, Case, and will you welcome Case and join me in welcoming him? Welcome to the LSE and to the Royal Academy.
Thank you. Thank you very much for this nice introduction. Do we have to do something with this? Because you wanted to show this as an intro.
Oh, I don't know about that. Go Well, maybe this is the lecture. I don't know. What is the surprise? Keep on going.
Okay, that's the next lecture here.
Okay.
Sorry.
So, probably those are the lectures that are after this lecture. This man is one of my partners in our office. His name is Ruud Gietema. He's an urban designer, but he is also a farmer. You see, he's very keen on being a farmer because he has his own fashion dresser who designs clothes in the wake of his profession. He has built a farm, which you can see here, in the nondescript style. It's quite new, this farm, in a design of our office in the polders in the IJsselmeer. This design is the south extension of the city of Lelystad, and it borders on the natural wilderness that is there, but only 50 years old, because the polder is only 50 years old. But because the engineers did not manage to dry up the land over there, a new wilderness was generated, and this wilderness is now the only spot in the Netherlands where one can see the original landscape like it was before the Germans came. Of course, he sells flowers, but he also exhibits these flowers in his estate. And by way of combining functions, he also uses his house as a congress facility and other yard experience, etc. Here you see him with his father looking at a model of the new tomato entertainment plant in Spain. They are employing GAN technology, and of course they are working with young Moroccan delinquents that are not put in prison in the Netherlands but have to work on the farm. The airplane that you see symbolizes the fact that he has discovered that his roses and his tulips are being sold in the United States mainly in the same distribution points as old-timer cars from Europe. And that's why he packs these flowers into old-timer cars and flies them with jumbo jets to Atlanta, where they are distributed across the United States and sold. So you see, we have to do here with a rather complex type of farmer who does not deal with agriculture or with cattle anymore so much, but uses his farm to kind of combine rather extreme activities from all kinds of directions into a kind of functioning enterprise. This is a condition that is very much being generated in the Netherlands, also because of the privatization of society and the fragmentation of economics into one family consultant companies. Here you see this city extension of Lelystad Zuid. Here is the old Lelystad, and here you see the beginning of this wilderness. And he must be living somewhere here. And the scheme, as you see, is a scheme that is more looking like a forest or like a park than like a city extension. This has been done on purpose. You see that the build form invades from the city center, as you can maybe call it, down into this forest. And this is the way it was designed. We designed it explicitly, first of all, as a park with a certain mix of water, fields, and forest. And then we allow the planners and the project developers to invade this park gradually with development up to a certain critical mass, so that always a certain balance between built and unbuilt is guaranteed. But moreover, even if it would be filled completely with built form, we would in the meantime in every phase have a kind of finished situation. This is completely contrary to the practice of urban design up to now, where people develop greenfield extensions, at first make roads, 5 kilometers long, then canalization, infrastructure, etc., and the houses come 10 years later. In this way, the landscape is being spoiled, and also there is no gradual dealing with how we should deal in a sustainable way with our environment. Here you see this wilderness. It lies exactly between the city of Lelystad and the city of Almere in this polder, which is only 50 years old. This is an aerial photograph. And in this area, there has been cattle put in. These are auroxes. Of course, you know that the aurochs is extinct, but not there, because the biologists are gradually constructing a new aurochs from a Scottish cattle type, and from a Dutch cattle type, and from a German cattle type, and so on. And so they have managed in copying almost the original aurochs in this area. And this is living in a symbiosis with a certain type of horse. This type of horse used to be extinct, but has been put into this wilderness. They were only living in zoos. After a few years, a herd of about 300 horses was being generated. Half of the horses have been flown to Mongolia, where they have been put into the tundra in their original place, where they had been extinct for 150 years. Our farmer, Ruud Gietema, does not employ normal cattle anymore, but his Moroccan delinquents are taking care of these cows, because although you see it's complete wilderness, they all have, of course, these European Union yellow earmarks in their ear. Just in time, he bought some land in the north of Holland, next to the city of Groningen, where the agricultural land is not being used anymore, it's becoming obsolete, which generates a very paradoxical situation. A paradoxical situation in the sense that we Dutchmen now are draining land in order to create new water-related new towns, whereas 50 years ago we were fighting to death to keep the water out of our country. The whole not urbanized part of the Netherlands is gradually turning into a large lagoon with cities that look like this, where people can live on the water and sail in their boat, sometimes even to school or to their work. In Almere, on the south side of the wilderness that ends here, we have designed this neighborhood, which consists of a spine running from the city center towards the large lake. And this spine has on its northern side water-related blocks, and on this south side it has wood-related blocks. A very interesting aspect of it is that we also build here. It looks like we are building row houses, terraces, greenfield housing, but we like to call them urban farms, because like Gietema on a larger scale, increasingly people living in these greenfield areas start one family enterprises, which turns their row house into a kind of farm where everything what they do in their life is happening. This is more or less maybe a definition, modern definition of farm. You have a piece of land and you have a piece of built structure on top of it, and everything you do is being done there. And what is very interesting also is that we managed for the first time in the Netherlands, both here and here, to sell the land per plot to the people, but give them only half the plot for the price of a whole plot. And the other half of the plot is either water or forest, and is being managed in a collective way, in order to create an attractive environment in which you can also sail to your house. In order to, first of all, create romantic environments, and secondly, to create also a maximum efficiency of land use, Because whatever design I will show you tonight, we have a maximum efficiency of land use, because that's the only way we can convince the developers to work with us, because if we would not be so efficient, they would say we'd rather take a traditional architect or urban designer. So we always take care that we are extremely efficient, and the efficiency here you can read off that we, for instance, create one of the neighborhoods in this Almere by a software that we developed ourselves that can generate a growing amount of parcels of certain programmatic differentiation, and these parcels of individual houses settle themselves according to this software and the kind of site conditions that you put into, like if you want to have a park in the middle, and then create the most efficient parcelation and create also the shortest roads between access and the individual house, so that the land use factor is most efficient. Remarkably, this also leads to very nice English potato garden city landscapes. Here you see an example of recently realized urban farms by our office. You see they are in fact, of course, normal row houses, but there are some differentiations. For instance, we have made the same space on the ground floor as on the first floor. These spaces can be divided into rooms. There can be either a bathroom here, or there can be a bathroom here, or a kitchen there and a kitchen there. They're kind of flexible in their use, and they have a kind of access system which makes it possible to give such a house a double entrance, which means that you can basically have an office entrance in your house at the same time as well as for your dwelling. You can choose to work here or to work here or to live there or to live there, depending if you want to just jump into your boat or overlook the lake from your house. This is of course nice architecture, but like in England or like in the United States, the trend is of course this here. This is a new neighborhood that we also designed. That means we designed the urban design, we did not do the architecture. But we were forced to take these architects in our design. And we happily did that because we think that we are in a situation gradually, and that is becoming even stronger, it's a real trend, that we as urban designers cannot fully control the quality of public space and the architecture anymore. And therefore we have to look for strategies in which we can, by a very powerful urban design and public space active work, to kind of more or less neutralize the architecture of may or make the architecture unguilty. So for instance, this is a greenfield development near the city of Arnhem. Here's the city of Arnhem, here's the city of Nijmegen. It's a kind of agglomeration on the eastern border, which has been developed by the city in order to create 7,500 new homes for people from Arnhem there on a railroad. Here's going to be stationed. And we were asked to do the urban design, and what we did is we took this landscape and divided it into the original landscape parcels of meadows, forest parts, tree rows, dikes, ditches, canals, and made a kind of free composition in which garden villages of about 600 houses and freestanding villas could be built between the landscape, between the existing farms and between the station and the more dense developed central area. This is a very important strategy because the fragmentation and the kind of intermingling with the existing landscape takes care that you can start development anywhere, but that you can also stop development anywhere. This scheme is ready in every stage of completion, and it is designed in such a way that it doesn't spoil the landscape. So here you see an aerial photograph of the actual state of development. The first village is being built here, the second is being here. Existing farms all are being kept in the area, and you see that the landscape, agricultural landscape, is really intermingling with the new development. This is this neighborhood, of which I just showed you this house. And it's of course extremely bourgeois, extremely boring, but this is what the consumer on the moment wants. And what we can do about it is to force these people to create, these architects and developers, to create an enormous density and to create, like I showed you in this urban farm, in these row houses, to create plans and plots that allow for multiple use in the future. Only in such a way, creating a kind of urbanity, on one hand by concentrating public space and to by creating a kind of flexible structure in the houses. We don't care about style anymore. We can control the development of these villages. Extremely important becomes then the landscape design. The landscape design, which builds up a kind of set of coulisses in which you can camouflage these developments and create kind of original parts of landscape along the farms and along the main corridors of landscape that go through such a neighborhood. And also here we use this this software. It's a kind of software that that is based on swarm theory, like beehives, like bees go into a swarm. And the plots and the different programmatic parts of houses and streets, they look for each other in such a way that a maximum efficiency is being generated. And you see, it really looks like a grown set of farms. It looks really like a kind of environment where people feel at home. This is the neighborhood that comes out of it. Maybe it is so that our task is to create as much variability and anarchism in urban design, and at the same time create a kind of minimal order to give people the feeling that they are living in an environment that is maximally free. So my friend Gietema, who you see here, worked on a lot of these city extensions, and then we were sent to China to develop similar kind of constructions. So you see him here in Peking, in his just realized center, shopping center of his neighborhood. This image looks like it is in the Netherlands. We made everything out of brick, but it is a new town in the neighborhood of Beijing, and it has more or less the same typology that we employed in these urban designs in the Netherlands. Meantime, he has found a Chinese wife. They have two children, half Frisian, half Chinese. And she speaks Mandarin and is an architect from the Berlage Institute, and therefore we have now an enormous amount of commissions in China. Here you see one of our artificial canals that does not contain water yet. And here you see the brick housing along this canal and the community center that we also designed in this new town. The Chinese make better public space than the Dutch and the English, as you can see, because these developments are all private developments. They are a little bit like Los Angeles gated communities, with the difference that they are mostly a little bit more transparent. And therefore, there is a very strong emphasis on public space. These Chinese people all want to have two cars. And whenever we talk about the fact that, for instance, I don't drive a car, because I'm always taking public transport, and start a kind of moralistic story that they should watch out, that they will produce too much CO2 or I don't know what, carbon dioxide, they always have one answer on this, and that is, we want the same as you. What can we say about that? We were asked to make two designs for two cities near Shanghai of 250,000 inhabitants. This is the central district of Shanghai, and we have here, you see this kind of tong, which is also a little bit like a Dutch polder landscape. It's called Gakao, and you see here a kind of tip where there's a small island, and here should be a town satellite of 250,000 residents, and here should be a city of 250,000 residents, plus a new container, harbor container terminal. All these cities are concentrations of approximately 250,000 inhabitants. This was a consultation between, I think, four offices by the Shanghainese government, and we designed a kind of transformation concept in the spirit of our own neighborhoods in the Netherlands. So we took the landscape, which consists of rice paddies and very beautiful farmland, and we made with an engineering office a water management system, which was which had a very sustainable dealing with the landscape. And then we said, okay, from this basic structure onwards, you can gradually fill in the area with built form from certain points of departure. When we discussed this with the Chinese authorities, they said, but why are you doing that? Because this is going to change. And we said, what do you mean going to change? These are fantastic agricultural landscapes with very nice farms and rice paddies. And they said, yeah, but we are going to build it all in one go, and all these people, these farmers here, will be harbor workers in the near future. The same happened in this computer, in this container city. Here you see the bridge towards the container island, which would be a kind of container terminal from which everything by train and car would go into the mainland. And we designed a city that would kind of have a strong, a radical functional mix between living and between industry. So we created a central park like ID, and this central park contained both a train emplacement with container cranes, etc., an industry park, as well as entertainment and recreation, around which residential neighborhoods were grouped in an attempt also very large-scale, modern, functional aspects to mix maximally with each other. Also here, the Chinese said, we want Rotterdam. You have 40 kilometers of harbor that has nothing to do with the city, and we want a city which has nothing to do with the harbor. So in both cases, our scheme was dismissed on the basis of a too sustainable and too much on mixed development based ID. Yes, that is our Greenfield experience in a short go, and now we go into the city. And in city development is always very difficult. Most politicians and most city directors, architect directors of town planning offices, think that a city should be have a vision, especially for its center. And from this vision on, the city should develop towards this kind of image that these politicians create for their city. But you can simply see in almost all cities that this ID never works, and that therefore the city center is a succession of different ideologies that more or less change every 7 years. A rather biblical cyclical process. I can show you three slides in which you can see how this works. This is the roundabout that was created or designed after the war by the Rotterdam Town Planning Department to make a large traffic knot going across the River Maas to the south of the city that didn't exist yet. And this traffic knot was laid exactly on top of the oldest harbor of Rotterdam. The idea was Rotterdam is a city on the river, on the north bank of the city, of the river. There's no real interest in centrum development on the south side. So we take the motorway coming out here. This will be the arrival of the motorway. We do not care about the history because Rotterdam has been destroyed in the war anyway. So we make a pond in the middle of the roundabout symbolizing the oldest harbor of Rotterdam that lies exactly on this spot. And then create a new city which will have a kind of positive development in the next 100 years. There was a very strong city grid, etc. Not even 25 years later, the same spot looked like this. The old harbor of Rotterdam, the oldest, where the river Rotter originally came into the River Maas, was reconstructed. It didn't exist after the war anymore, at least almost not anymore. it was blocked by a motorway in front of the city, so it had not this connection anymore with the river. But one had created an old ship's wharf here, in which rich project developers work on their boat on Saturday and Sunday. And a kind of romantic monkey rock-like housing structure around it was created in order to provide Amsterdam-like or Venetian-like atmosphere. So the city more or less imploded into an introvert character. It had been extroverted and directed towards the river from the north side for about 25 years in a kind of what people thought sustainable structure that would last forever. And not even 25 years later, the whole idea was reversed 180 degrees, and the idea of city on the water was imploded into a kind of coziness to canals within the city more than kind of a transparent relationship to a city on a large river. Not even 15 years later, this is the current situation. On the other bank, a whole new city center part is being generated. The city has decided to create from a city on the north bank of the river into a city where a river runs through. This is a very dangerous operation. You know this from Paris and London. In Paris, this is already the case for 1,000 years, and it is therefore self-evident and successful. In London, it is still even an enormous effort to bring enough critical mass on the other side of the bank. Maybe the Tate Modern has been the final blow that makes this concept successful. In Rotterdam, it was also tried by making a bridge and then by deciding that these former harbor areas were being filled. And one of the pioneers was this Hotel New York in the buildings of the former Holland-America line. Now, how do you do this? This is only possible in the Netherlands. For instance, we are working in German harbor areas where this is not possible, and I think in England it would also be difficult. If you want to create such a half of the city center on the other side of the river, of course no investor or no developer is the first one who's going to do that. And so what can we do in the Netherlands? We, for instance, decide that the biggest high court is going to be settled on the other bank of the river. Then we decide that the regional tax office is going to be settled on the other side of the river. And then we decide, you cannot see it here in this picture, but it was the big tower by Norman Foster. You see it here. By the way, Rotterdam is a collection of B buildings by famous architects, among others, Norman Foster and Renzo Piano. So the harbor authorities were put into this Foster building, and then there was an enormous critical mass of social and also subsidized private housing being put on the other side of the river. And of course, people didn't get allocations to build it. No, the authorities financed the whole thing in the sense that they made a guarantee of a 10-year lease for all the buildings, and then the investors and project developers, of course, wanted to build very much. We developed the most part of this neighborhood, which is interesting in the sense that we tried for one of the first times to kind of pull in these urban farms where I was talking about into the city. Normally, in the city center, new building consists more or less mainly out of apartments, social housing, or expensive apartment towers. But we managed to create terraced housing, which has the same structure again as I told you before. They have a flexible entrance on two sides. They have a double first floor and ground floor that they can use in a flexible way, so that this is a kind of working living unit and a family house, if you like, at the same time, being used for exactly the right kind of people that we want to pull back in the city to create a better balance, a better social balance in the inner city, because the inner city, of course, especially in cities as Rotterdam, has had a very monofunctional balance of different demographic groups that do not provide a sustainable quality for a social environment. So by means of creating masters of these kind of structures, both social stability, children, and work is being reintroduced into the city center. All kinds of typologies are being made there in terms of a typology of housing, of dwelling, always with in mind, back in mind, a kind of loft idea. So we make access systems that are at the same time terraces that can be glazed so that you can sit here also in winter. Front doors are double glazed doors so that you can open them as terraces. Spaces of plants are as large as possible. You can more or less take everything out. And you see that kind of leads to a social use of these decks that is much better than if you have simply an entrance on one side and a balcony on the other side. This kind of development of different stages for a city, in which the concept how a city is related to the water or another city that is related, leads in the end to the fact that we can say we cannot do anything about urbanism, maybe, because it's changing its idea all the time. But we think we can. One of the ideas that is being left is the idea of the archipelago, which you see here in front of the medieval city of Amsterdam, but unfortunately you don't see Amsterdam on this picture. But you should imagine yourself here the medieval town of Amsterdam, in which we created a master scheme, which was not so much a kind of fixed master scheme in which all these buildings are being fixed, but was more an idea that if you have a large activity in city renewal, and we are not able to kind of cope with this changing ideologies, then the only concept that we can use in the end is a kind of archipelago idea in which different islands of morphology, of architectural characters are being built that have nothing to do with each other, but create an enormous pluriformity. And by creating this pluriformity, again, and by their position, create a kind of coherence in front of the city again. So you see here, here's the central station. This is the first neighborhood. This is the second neighborhood. This is still a very traditional neighborhood. This was built by OMA in the 1980s. It was their first project. This is a recent development on the harbor pier, which is constructed as canal blocks with single houses, as you can see. Here's one of those single houses. And in the end, there are two island, two archipelago fragments. One is made out of large buildings that lie like great ships on the shore, and one is made up out of very low-dense patio dwellings that also have this living, working potential. They all have this kind of ground floor, first floor connection. And in the end, there's a new island just beyond Amsterdam in the same lake as where Almere and Lelystad and my friend's farm are lying, which has been made out of sand, out of nothing, and there's created a kind of new neighborhood that more or less collects the most important ideas that came forward out of these islands of this archipelago, and which combines in a much stronger way housing, working, amenities in an urban grid. This archipelago idea you can of course employ also in more coherent neighborhoods. For instance, here you see a kind of 19th century neighborhood where there's a kind of peace fitted in an old waterworks area, where the buildings are being urban villas surrounded by a wall that protects against wind and noise of industry and traffic, which kind of makes a relationship in material and in structure with the surrounding neighborhood, but is nevertheless completely different. In this neighborhood, a maximum use of public space by private use is being generated by giving all the ground floor dwellings a garden, by giving all the upper dwellings a roof terrace, and giving all the sandwich apartments that are in between roof and ground floor a garden on the other side inside the area, creating a kind of landscape of allotments in which people grow themselves their vegetables, and which also very strongly increases social security in such neighborhoods. If we keep in mind this kind of thinking about concepts for city, if you have to realize a large piece of waterfront development like this in the city of Hamburg, you are talking about completely different dimensions. This is the whole inner city of Hamburg. Hamburg is a city of between 2 and 3 million inhabitants. And here's the famous Speicherstadt, which is a set of very beautiful brick warehouses. And this whole area, the free harbor, has to be developed as the new harbor city, which creates a situation in which you almost have a kind of twin situation, a twin situation between the old reconstructed medieval town from the war and this this harbor city. And in fact, by working on this project, not only this archipelago idea, which you can see clearly coming back in this scheme, but also a kind of notion of what we call programlessness becomes very important. Because such an area will not be finished within the next 20 years, which means that you can not only predict what how the structure is going to be developed, in which tempo it will be developed, but you can also not predict what kind of programs, what kind of functions in such a city will be developed. So we decided to design a city without a program and try to make a city that only derives its quality from public space, from the morphological shape of building blocks, from the differentiation of formal aspects into different quarters, and for concentrations of possible public functions. So you see here that this kind of boring scheme, maybe what you saw first, is in fact a scheme that has different rules based on the same building block in which these building blocks completely can differentiate into different kind of typologies. So here there will be a real German 19th century neighborhood ambiance. You know that the German 19th century neighborhoods are extremely attractive. So there will be a very strong discipline here in this neighborhood. Then along the River Elbe, where that's very wide, we create a zone where high-rise is allowed. And in zones, for instance, between two water basins, we create more transparent blocks that have a relationship to the water on both sides, all within the same kind of language of typology and dimension. And you see here how this transparency and this differentiation of district functions. Also, we design, like I showed you also in the beginning, we design on purpose schemes in which there is place for bad architecture. Because you will never be able in these times, with all kind of stakeholders having an influence on the development, that you can completely control architectural quality up to the last detail. So you should design urban environments in a way that kind of the mass of your buildings, of your architecture, creates a kind of multi-leveled, pluriformistic spectrum. Of course, in which you try to make a maximum variety of maybe of styles or of expressions, but leave space for kind of these kind of uncontrollable problems. So that's what we do in Hamburg, and here you see the first buildings being constructed. This is an old warehouse where Herzog Dömeron is going to make the opera house. This is the wall of this warehouse strip. And here you see the same area later. These are the new buildings in front of the warehouse strip. This is this water-related area. And here you see in the end this opera house being put on top of the warehouse at the end of the pier. You see it again. Now, if we work on these blocks, on the dimensions, on how you fit in the city, how dense you can build, how high you can build, there's always a very simple and cliché-like political problem, and that is we don't want high-rises because our church is the highest point in the city, and so on. You also have here view corridors that have to do with the position of St. Paul visible from several parts in the city, etc., which is also legitimate. So we decided that this kind of difficult discussion about high-rises in the city should be tackled in another way. Not in a way that you cannot build high-rises unless there are some points where you are allowed to build high-rises, and we determine where those points are. No, we say you may make high-rises everywhere, and we create a kind of system in which we can determine from which point in the city you can see the high-rises or not. This is also done by the same type of software that I showed you for this parcellation system, but then in three dimensions, in which you can create several models, in which, in the end, you can exactly determine where shade is falling into streets and where not, and where from which points in the city you can see a high-rise building or not. And in the end, it looks a little bit like this model. The computer program generates envelopes that are being symbolized by these wireframes here. And as long as you build within those envelopes, the whole area complies with the parameters that you put in beforehand. So all these colored buildings that have different shapes are being built and realized within these envelopes. Because they are keeping their volume within those envelopes, they always comply with these view lines like we put in. So in other words, we take a large piece of cheese, let's say, instead of we say there's nothing. Then we cut streets and squares out of the cheese. Then the program starts to cut out of the volume planes in which shadows are being cast. And in the end you get envelopes, and within the envelopes buildings can be built that are perfectly in place. So this system we have employed, for instance, in Rotterdam, in this triangle, where you see here different variants of possibilities, where a point of departure was, for instance, that every dwelling in every apartment in a tower should have sunlight and should have a view at the river and should not have too many shadows from the other one. And here you see little slender apartment towers being built in this triangle. And the interesting aspect is that we do not determine the shape, the position, and the architecture of these towers. Rather, due to the fact that they are unpredictable and that they are different and that they are pluriform, a very interesting urban environment is created. These buildings contain apartments, of course. We call these apartments lofts, and in England they are 50 square meters. In the Netherlands they are 150 square meters for the same price. And also working on these kind of buildings creates the same question about programlessness as in urban design. Even in buildings, you see that buildings after some time get another use. And for instance, in the loft buildings in New York, which are in fact old vertical factories, you could say that the urbanity and the quality of society life in these buildings is better in their second use or in their third use as it was for the use where these buildings were originally designed for. Which is a notion that Mr. Malevich, the artist, the constructivist artist from Russia, already knew, because he said, my architectons, which for instance this one would stand in Manhattan, are being designed to just be there. They're made out of concrete, glass, and tar paper, and people can sit on their decks in the summer whenever it is nice weather. So in this harbor city in Hamburg, for instance, a building was designed which had no program during the whole phase of design. It was designed as a reference to an old warehouse. It was made in brick. Then it was perforated in order to give light access from street and city to harbor and vice versa. It had created a very high grade level entrance zone in order to make spaces for workshops, galleries, restaurants, etc. And only on the moment that the building was realized, the functions became clear and the people invaded into the building. Details for high water, etc. Now this idea of let's make not a new building for a function, but let's make a squatted warehouse, is something that has been derived, has been generated in the harbor of Amsterdam, and has also had a very, very strong effect on city planning by the town planning department and also by the investors in the Netherlands and now also in this part in Germany. In that respect, this building, Load 6, in the Amsterdam harbor is very interesting, because it was part of a set of buildings that were very derelict and very ugly, Docklands buildings, that were on one of those piers that the developers and the town planning department wanted to completely make tabula rasa and fill it with new housing. And then of course 50% social housing or 40% social housing and the rest private housing. And people in these buildings refused to pull out, and made such a difficult case that it was clear that these buildings were not to be pulled down and that also the users could not be gotten out of this building. And then one of the users, who already rented a lot of these warehouses from the city for one guilder per month, started to become a developer. And he became an alternative developer, a little bit in the sense of Tom Bloxham in Manchester, with Urban Splash, and maybe you've heard of him. He started to kind of work with low budget, high culture functions, whereas the normal investors in the town planning department, of course, were active with low culture, high budget investments. And the interesting aspect of this building is that in the end it became so successful that official high budget renters went into it, expensive tax lawyers, etc., and the building became a kind of cult building. It also created an urbanity, a kind of mixture of functions and activities that would never have been achieved when one would have built the whole neighborhood alone. But what was even more interesting is that the investors who then started to develop this complex of old warehouses and new buildings around it, they asked these squatters, these kind of self-made developers, to kind of be companions, be partners in the development of this project. So in the end, here a very interesting combination is being generated directly next to the cruise terminal and the central station of Amsterdam, in which the economy of and the urban quality of the project is derived from a kind of low budget and high budget development culture that are normally completely separated from each other. Most of the time the low budget go first and then they are being repressed and pushed away by the high budget. But in this case we arrived at making a combination which also is being reflected into the way buildings are being refurbished and also into the way users are being going to be in the buildings as well. To achieve that we had to make buildings that are standing on top of these warehouses. So you see here a building that goes first up and then it goes to the right and then it goes on the roof of a warehouse, so that we create a lot of density, and this density creates income, and this income is being put into the more vulnerable urban functions that are in the rest of the project. You see the view across the harbor. In the end, of course, we all want this. We're in a kind of natural harbor situation. Something like that over some years has been developed. You see here is a kind of luxury hotel and there's an old warehouse, blending both on the programmatical, on the dimensional and on the cultural level together into a kind of pluriformic mix. In that respect, we also work very strongly with the tension between space and public space, or built volume and public space in these, especially in these harbor areas. Because like in a painting by de Chirico, in harbors you can very often not say whether the space is more determined by the public space, by the emptiness, or by the objects of the buildings themselves. The conclusion is that they are linked to each other in a kind of death or life relationship. And that kind of this alternating feeling of the space becoming more important or the built volume become more important is in fact one of the most exaggerating aspects of these harbor developments. So we try to translate this into a scheme in Rotterdam, an urban scheme in which sometimes buildings are like chess pieces on a field and sometimes buildings create that is cut out of streets and squares, and even a park is being treated as a building in this field. So you get alternating the feeling that you have a set of buildings on a field or space that is being cut out between different objects, which gives an enormous oscillating spatial experience, which you can see here, a kind of on-purpose designed. Maybe it's a bit kitschy in relation to the theories that I just put on the table. An on-purpose designed irregular anarchistic set of building volumes. But in the end, this kind of quality of space and buildings, and also, of course, again, these urban farms that are in this scheme, will probably make the area very successful. This is the first development in the scheme. This whole area will be built full. And you see it is combined with a new boulevard that kind of replaces all harbor functions here. A new sports area, a theater, museums, loft buildings, etc. Some people like it very much. Even some developers, and some people kind of despise it because they think so something like that is not possible as a kind of serious attempt of urbanism. And finally, maybe we come back to the suburbs and the harbor and industry areas at the same time, which is maybe also very applicable to some English cities. We have, in fact, a bigger problem in Rotterdam with these kind of harbor areas than we have with inner city renewal areas, because these areas are gigantic. This is, for instance, the Waalhaven. This Waalhaven is
has the size of the inner city of Hamburg, for instance. It borders the south neighborhoods, the residential neighborhoods of the south of Rotterdam here. You see this pier that I just showed you. And the problem of these areas is that they have no crisis in the sense of economic crisis, but they tend to kind of rapidly develop into second-hand business parks, like you see here in the lower part of the harbor, a kind of endless tissue of nondescript sheds and boxes in which all kind of non-harbor related activities are being housed, and they kind of more or less eat up this whole harbor area if we do not try to kind of make an intervention, which is extremely problematic, not only because a very vast monoculture, which is opposite an urban mix, is being generated, but a large problem is that on the other hand, all these red spots that you see here are future greenfield developments around the area of Rotterdam. And you see here this harbor, and you can clearly see that this whole greenfield development, creating mobility, destroying the landscape, blah, 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 can be easily put in a surface like this. So if you would mount a suburb into this harbor, kind of close it, and you would kind of easily in the Rotterdam harbor be able to kind of assimilate all the future necessary housing estates that are being demanded by the market for the next 50 to 100 years. But nobody's doing it by several reasons. First of all, the people who live in these greenfield developments don't want to live in the city. They are kind of, in the meantime, by three generations, such a breed of middle-class uniform homonites, that these people do not want to live in the city because they are completely distorted by change and by heterogeneity. A second thing is that, of course, development is more expensive, and it's much more easy to buy agricultural land and to turn agricultural land into housing. And so there are a lot of problems that kind of create a big danger for the city, because in the end we have kind of a Detroit horror vision in front of us, namely that we will have the city center as a shopping center. We'll have some nice 19th century neighborhoods. Then there will be a lot of business parks, enterprises, a kind of jungle where we go through, and then we will have kind of cozy suburbs 20 kilometers or 10 kilometers out of the city center. So we've now started with the city a very difficult process, which is called City Harbors, which is a new limited company owned both by the city as by the port authorities. Port authorities, of course, have the most money in Rotterdam because they are the biggest port in the world, and they earn astronomical amounts of money. And together we have created this Waalhaven platform, which also will be a kind of interactive website. And in this platform, the port authority, city, local residents, potential users, investors from outside, and initiators of projects are being brought together. And we are developing developments and ideas, not on the basis of that we design an urban scheme, but we say now the structure of the area is okay, and we are not going to bother about future visions of nice shapes, but we are going to now put the area into transformation, and how we will put it into transformation, that's what we will be thinking about now. And this transformation process has a very wide spectrum, and now the 1970s are coming back, because we work both with temporary uses, with low-budget uses, with official investments, with private capital, with industry, with private houses connected with industry, all at the same time, as well as with, for instance, local container terminals that want to stay there. So you have a kind of, we will get a new urban condition in which we have virtually all aspects of scale and all aspects of activity together. We have even got a kind of permission from the local province to be not so strict with the environment laws in this experiment. And therefore it's also necessary that we very strongly, not so much design, but analyze existing structures. We do not only analyze buildings or scale of typologies of buildings, but we also analyze the surfaces and materials that are in the harbor, which we reuse when we do reconstruction, or we put them in a bank in order to use them later again, so that you kind of keep this quality of harbor atmosphere into your scheme. Also, we analyze, like I said, very strongly not only the hardware, the physical structures, but also the software, which is the activities that is housed in the different buildings. This is, for instance, kind of a freak building, but we also analyze official offices of harbor police, etc., in order to kind of make a complete palette of the potential of differentiation that we have in such an area. So maybe you can look at this picture as the last what I want to show you tonight, which is a kind of representation of the transformation and realization process that we are doing now on the moment. In the 70s or in the 60s, the investors and the central politicians could just build anything they wanted. In the 70s, they were stopped first by the hippies and the post-68ers, and then by the kind of officialized resident participation movement, which of course didn't work because it stopped investment on one hand, and also it led to a kind of complete stakeholder Babylon on the other hand. And so we are now in the beginning of 2000, and in the meantime we have kind of created a situation which maybe looks a little bit like this. We do not simply let investors build everything anymore. We also do not let the inhabitants tell them what to build, but we kind of create beforehand a kind of process of stakeholder management and process management, in which every stakeholder group will get its own place of influence. So probably here the squatters are, they will not have so much influence anymore, and here will be probably the city, who will be coordinating between all kinds of other stakeholders. And in this way, by kind of pre-programming, kind of decision-making and planning process, and by incorporating all kind of activities from semi-permanent to permanent, we are managing to kind of start transformation processes in environments that normally would either develop on the autopilot in a kind of non-urban monocultural environment, or would not happen anything at all. Thank you very much.
We do have the opportunity for 10 minutes of questions. There are some roving microphones, one or two. If you are able to ask a question, can I ask you to ask a question, not to make a long statement about your view of the world, but related very much to Case's very provocative, very informative talk. And Case, I would like to start, if I may, by just picking up on an issue which is in a way summarized, of course, by this extraordinary jigsaw, which deals so much with the process, not just with the product. I mean, what we did see in your images today, first of all, is the extraordinary scale of interventions and clarity of thought behind them. I have walked with Case through some of these neighborhoods, which at one level you can see these aerial pictures and they look scary, they're big. They look like terribly new things, and the English don't like new things. We refer to it as fatal newness. The reality is, remembering as I walked through
part of that South Rotterdam area. It just feels like an everyday piece of city, even though it's only been there for 5, 6, 7 years. And I think that quality is something which is very rare and needs to be understood. My question is, who's leading who here in the good sense of the word? Because either you have incredibly sophisticated politicians who are providing the space for someone like you and others to create the sort of product that you're doing, or you're leading the policymakers into doing something they don't know what to do. And I think that for us, certainly in the UK at the moment, is a very interesting issue, and wonder whether you could comment on that.
Well, I think, first of all, there was in the Netherlands a very strong hit by 1968. And this really led to a kind of student revolution in which older professors, politicians, and decision makers were put into pension. And there was a trend in which social democrat politicians became, by this process, very young. In 1975, maybe the average age of a Dutch social democratic politician was about 10 to 15 years younger than a German social democratic politician. And I think that was also that's also in relation to England. So there was a kind of very young set of politicians being generated that were most of them social democratic. This was combined with the fact that the building industry in the Netherlands is very important, both on the level of harbor and water and land winning development, as well as on the level of production of housing, etc. We had a very shortage of housing after the war, and an enormous influx of immigrants into the Netherlands after the war. And the Netherlands state has always been financing and kind of being the motor of a lot of built development, which has led to the situation that these politicians kind of promoted a lot of built volume and urban design in the post-war Netherlands. Now, these people who were mainly quite dogmatic into the 1980s were also in favor of modernistic architecture because that was socialistic, and because they had the power of financing, and because they had kind of the position in the cities, there was what people sometimes call a kind of dictature of modernism in urban design and architecture being going on in the Netherlands. And the interesting thing is that in the process of privatization after this, and also during the beginning of the privatization wave that came afterwards, these people went into private enterprise and became massive directors of project development companies and real estate investors. So instead of that, we had a kind of very strong move into privatization, which would immediately change the whole spectrum of landscape and change into kind of romantic and non-quality, like we say it. In fact, this kind of movement was to be continued into the private realm. And I think one must say that this is a very special condition in the Netherlands, because the Dutch, of course, have always worked with each other in dialogue. The worker has always been in a dialogue with the director and the mayor and the parliament politicians, because this is generated from the fact that it is, first of all, a small-scaled and small country, but mainly because of the fact that people had to cooperate in the times that the water was still not controllable, and therefore very decentralized decision-making structures were generated that still have their influence in modern society. So that's one of the reasons why also, surprisingly, in the Netherlands around the end of the 1980s, young architects got so much chance to build. They went from the public commissions into private commissions, and then had, so to say, a kind of first go paid by the state.
So that explains, it can only be a social democrat politician turned developer who builds a building without a function. and which was the most extraordinary photograph I've ever seen. Anyway, are there any questions? There's one over there. I think, could someone take a microphone? Oh, fine. I'll take that one.
Thank you. Hi. Going back to the Hamburg scheme, where the design is actually, you mentioned it doesn't specify the programs in the overall urban design. Then in such case, how do you guarantee that the overall development isn't totally driven or taken away by the developers, and that the overall outcome becomes an area full of, I guess, higher or middle class inhabitants, and the lower class gets driven away?
Yes, we have a toolkit, maybe you can call it like that, which controls certain things. For instance, we say that all ground floor spaces and mezzanine spaces should be transparent and should be used by public directed activities in such an area, for instance. And we, for instance, state that the height of the ground floor and mezzanine area must be, for instance, at least 6 meters in order to provide the flexibility to take floors out or to add floors in and to make this kind of height suitable for public directed functions. Then we have a control mechanism, for instance, when blocks are too large. We say that single developments by developers may only have a maximum ground occupation of so much square meters.
Who is we? The city authority?
The city and the people that are in charge of supervising this, which right. is, for instance, we. And we are appointed as supervisors, and we create a set of building rules that are being an agreement between the people who are building there and the city. And so every block or every architecture, every building has to be built according to this agreement. Then you can, for instance, say that in a certain grain scale, a minimum of X percent of apartments should be into each block or into a set of blocks. And so so you go on with an amount of rules that create a certain guarantee of quality and of diversity and of the relationship between inside and outside, without exactly determining for the investors what it will look like or what exactly is being into it. What is very important is that we do have appointed very some key points into the scheme as points for large public functions, like for instance the sea aquarium or a cruise terminal, or this opera house. Those are points in the scheme that we control in a much stronger way. But we do not say whether the sea aquarium is on the position of the opera or vice versa. That's the kind of negotiation process that comes afterwards. So the trick is to kind of make a scheme that is not boring, flexible, and exchangeable, but has a kind of urbanistic and architectural characteristic from beforehand, but at the same time leaving a lot of freedom for possible infill.
Other question? I think Fred Manson and then you. Okay, well, you and then Fred. No, Fred and then you.
My interest is about your work. What you've talked about in your presentation is largely about process, which leads to buildings. When you go to China, you've built buildings which look surprisingly like the ones you built in the Netherlands. Did you involve consultation, and did the process lead to different results when you worked in China?
Well, I think working in China is something completely different, because there is no process, which we have learned we have realized yet now a first project, and we have done these two consultations on these new towns, and up to now we have discovered that that there is no process. There is simply being decided that there is going to be built there,
and that the program is such and that it has to be ready then, and you have to comply with that and do it. But the interesting thing is that we notice that in the course of working with one client, you are able to gradually educate them into the direction that we like to have. And for instance, the brick village that you saw, this is a private developer in China called Goldfield, of which the oldest director is 37 years old. And this is a kind of phenomena in China that has never been happened after the war since now, because it was always the oldies that were the deciding what happened. And with this company, they also come regularly to Rotterdam. We really have the feeling that we can gradually develop a kind of relationship that is more than just doing something for them or else not. But I must say, I am not doing those projects myself because I have small children and I stay within Europe.
Last question at the front.
My question is very similar to China, because I'm thinking about the relationship between you, maybe I call the foreign consulting company, and the other local authorities or local peoples in the outside countries, I mean outside of the Netherlands. You are invited to do some of the promoting these ideas to the countries outside of the Netherlands, such as in Germany or in China. How do you do this persuading process? You say China is different. Do you mean that China is absolutely different from the Germany, and the Germany process is similar to the Netherlands, or that every country is different? So what's the relationship between the consulting company and the foreign local government, the foreign local peoples?
Yeah, I think many countries are very different, and which means that you cannot always work in the same way in one country as in the other country. This is a little bit the case between England and the Netherlands, and between the Netherlands and Germany, or between the Netherlands and Switzerland. But these are differences that are all embedded within a certain way a democratic European culture. So in that sense, they are very strongly to be overcome, and there is a situation generated in which you can it's very fruitful to do that within Europe, because in some conditions, in the one side you have very much benefit to use in the other side, and vice versa. There are, for instance, I would not be able to say you can better build in Holland than in Germany, because there are in Germany also very interesting advantages in doing urban design and architecture in relation to the Netherlands, and vice versa. But in working in China is completely different, because the parameters and the society relationships between the different actors in the process are completely different. The financing is completely different. So you are, like we sometimes say, virtually working on the moon. But what is not on the moon is a kind of general development of society which tends towards family life in the first stage, and then tending towards divorced family life in the second stage, and so on and so on. And they have kind of the same, they develop kind of the same pattern of behavior in the environment of the city. And by transposing, for instance, urban design principles that we employ into this situation, a kind of interesting tension is there between a completely different society situation, a kind of gradual tendency to, for instance, comply with the American dream, and a kind of working with sustainable mixed development from the European heritage. And this kind of relationship between these three extremes creates, in fact, very interesting situations in which also rapid evolution in ideas is possible. So that's, but like I said, I am not so much into that process.
Well, maybe with your small children, we need to bring you a bit closer than China and to engage you in exactly similar issues, I have to say. We could be talking about similar culture changes and what's happening a mile and a half east of here than some of the conditions that you now personally, but your practice does, operate in thousands of miles away. I mean, it's not by chance that we're ending your talk with conversations and questions which are to do with the political DNA and the cultural DNA and how it relates to your architecture and your urbanism. Of course, that's not just the fact that we're talking at the London, you're talking at the London School of Economics, and many of the people are interested in those processes, but it's also recognition of something that I think to us at the LSE is central, that unless the design professions generally, architects, urban designers and planners, engage with the political process at the level that you are exhibiting and talking about, we end up just doing, you know, little things like that in pink and green, and that's it, objects in the landscape of beauty. I want to conclude this talk by thanking you, Kees, for stimulating elucidation of, I think, the processes which lie behind some of the work, not dwelling, even though you could have, on the fact that some of the buildings, if you remember, amongst the 97 slides you saw, of great beauty, just the relationship between glass and brick, the fact that different people from different backgrounds and different ages would inhabit them, as I have experienced with extraordinary simplicity and calm. But first, most of all, thank you for the extraordinary modesty that you show in actually having an enormous impact in a very, very big issue which affects us all, which is the issue of dwelling and design. Thank you very much for coming here.